Hi, I'm Josephine Ensign, author of Skid Road, On the Frontier of Health and Homelessness in an American City, and Way Home, Journeys Through Homelessness. For the past 40 years, I've worked as a nurse practitioner providing primary care to people experiencing poverty and homelessness. I have the lived experience of homelessness as a young adult. I live and work in Seattle, a city with our nation's third highest number of people experiencing homelessness. Only New York City and Los Angeles have higher numbers. The Skid Road podcast aims to amplify a diversity of voices about homelessness in the Seattle area. Beginning in 2015, when a state of emergency was declared for homelessness in our city and county, I've done a series of oral history interviews with local people living and working at the intersection of health and homelessness. Public health nurses, emergency department physicians, politicians, heads of nonprofit agencies, activists, and frontline staff. People who have not only endured homelessness, but who are now housed and are working on creative solutions to homelessness. I've learned a lot from my conversations with all of these people, and I want to share their insights with you. On a semi-weekly basis, I'll post a new podcast episode featuring these conversations, interspersed with some of my own reflections. Learn more about this project through my website at josephineensign.com. Please subscribe to this podcast and share it with others. Thanks for listening. So I'm Josephine Ensign here today at Jack Straw Studios on Tuesday, February 2nd, 2016, with Reverend Craig Rennebaum, who's told me to call him Craig, so I will. And Craig, as you know, we were talking about, this is for the Skid Road Project, which is an oral history project that's trying to increase an understanding of the complexity of charity healthcare in King County, Washington, and charity kind of in little quotations, including kind of social determinants of health. So the first question that I had for you is, what led you to the work that you do?
Well, I think the most immediate precipitating event was an experience when I was a pastor at Pilgrim Congregational Church up on Capitol Hill. And this would have been 1976, 77. I'd been in Seattle for a couple of years, and we had a number of people sleeping around the church. But one fellow in particular came and slept in the doorway of the chapel. And he started there on a Monday night, and Tuesday morning I came early to the church, and I saw four bags of garbage at each corner of the little chapel doorway area. And it was a challenge to engage this fellow. He was very wary, distant, protective. And he finally muttered something about evil goes to what it knows, and that somehow these bags would attract whatever evil forces were at work and protect him and the church. So there was some indication that he was having some pretty extraordinary kind of thinking going on. And the next morning, I found him there again, and he had more bags of garbage. By Thursday, he had accumulated a box of motor oils from a local gas station dumpster and some cooking oil from behind a restaurant and some lies and solvents from another garbage can somewhere, and some paint thinners, and it was really toxic materials. And we have some kids passing by. So at that point, I had a member of the church who was part of the county designated mental health professionals, and I consulted with him, and he suggested calling the CDMHPs to see if this guy could get some help. And in fact, I was talking with him, and he was very frightened, very, very fearful, very elaborate sort of scenarios, delusions around, gave expression to that fear. And I said to him, you know, I think maybe the safest place that you could go would be to the hospital because they've got security, they've got staff there. I think you'd be in the best place possible, you know, given what's going on with you. And I said, I can get some people out here to talk with you about that and help you get to the hospital. And so I called the CDMHPs Friday morning. They came out.
So maybe for listeners that don't that don't know that acronym,
County Designated Mental Health Professionals, right, which in the state of Washington are people with the authority in any county mm-hmm. to interview, outreach, and interview individuals, and if they feel they're a danger to themselves or to others, or at risk for their health, gravely disabled is the term, mm-hmm. they can be taken involuntarily to the mm-hmm. hospital if necessary. So I called the CDMHPs. They came out. The fellow called himself Sterling Hayden, I think, after the actor, and we were sitting in my office. I mean, we had developed some trusting relationship mm-hmm. at that point. And the CDMHPs interviewed him. It was very symptomatic of some very bizarre and strange thinking. And then the CDMHPs said that they agreed that the hospital would be the right place for him. And then they turned to us, both Sterling and myself, and he said, well, can you take me? And they said, no, we can't. And I looked at them. I was just astonished. What's the problem? I said. He said, well, we can only provide transportation to people to the hospital if we're committing them involuntarily. We can't mm-hmm. arrange for transportation or help them get to the hospital if they want to go. And I said, well, but
that makes a lot of sense.
you guys are the experts. You know what? He's built a rapport with you. He's willing to go. Why can't we do this? We can't. We're not authorized to provide for voluntary patients. And I said, and at that point, Sterling became very agitated.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned to me and said, you promised them.
Right,
you said
trust.
They would take me.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I had every expectation. I thought they would. This is what they would do. And he jumped up and he ran out of my office. And I said, I'll go get him, but tell me, what do I need to do? And they said, take him to Harborview. And so I dashed out after Sterling, and by the time I got down to the street from the second floor, he had disappeared. And the CDMHPs left, and about a week or two later, I was reading the Seattle Times, and in a filler little piece in the back page of the paper was a little note that a transient had been found dead, hypothermia, under a viaduct downtown, and name was Sterling Hayden.
Mm.
So I several things out of that. One is that I realized that severe and persistent mental illness can be indeed a life-threatening issue. Mm. One of the realities is that the life expectancy for folks who are homeless and have a co-occurring mental illness, life expectancy for men is about 45, women is 44. So, I mean, if you have this disorder and you're out on the street, your likelihood of living a full life is substantially at risk. Second thing I realized was that the system, the mental health system, was not organized in any rational way to respond to the real needs of people. And that if you were going to advocate for folks in the mental health system, you really needed to understand how that system worked, and both to help people navigate it as it is, but also to change it so that it was more proactive and appropriately responsive to people with serious mental illness. The third thing I realized was that just as in the larger community, there was a lot of stigma and lack of understanding, even with graduate-level training as a pastor. I'd had one sentence in my 3 years of seminary training about major mental illness.
Not really.
And that was in a pastoral care course in seminary, and the sentence was, if somebody's mentally ill, refer them to a psychiatrist.
There you go.
Period. We didn't talk about what a psychiatrist does. We didn't talk about what mental illness is. Just, you know, it was sort of like, oh, if somebody's mentally ill, that's not your responsibility.
Or who has access to the psychiatrist.
Yeah, I mean, so I realized that you need to know what the system is. You need to know how to navigate it and help transform it. But we have just a tremendous amount of education to do about mental illness as an area of healthcare, and a lot to do to educate both allied professionals to the health field, pastors, counselors, so on, and the general public, including congregations. Mm-hmm. So that seed planted with the experience with Sterling became 10 years later the mental health chaplaincy, where I began working full-time on the streets with individuals who were homeless and mentally ill and helping them gain access to the system, helping do education in the community, mm-hmm. helping do some advocacy to change the system.
So tell me a little bit more about the chaplaincy, the street chaplaincy, how you got it formed, your idea was for it.
Yeah, it started with some definition of the problem, and this was enhanced for me when I was doing my doctoral work. I spent time as a chaplain on a psychiatric unit in a county hospital in the Bay Area, and we would provide 10 days, 2 weeks, more of intensive care for people, and then discharge would be literally back to the streets. Mm-hmm. or maybe somebody would be discharged home, but with an appointment at a community mental health center 3 weeks, a month later. Mm-hmm. So, and it really came to a head one day when I saw a person who had, I got a call saying, so-and-so's down in the emergency room and they're asking for you as a chaplain. Went down, it was one of our patients who'd been discharged at 11 this morning and was back in the ER at 4 o'clock this afternoon with nowhere to go, and saying, can you get me back in the hospital? I feel safe here and not in the community. So I think there was a realization as I was doing that graduate work that there was a need for somebody to be out in the community, available to people. And I think the key was to be available without requirement, without condition, so that, I got funding for the chaplaincy from a group of congregations and individuals. So I didn't have to ask people anything in order to give them services. Mm-hmm. I could just be there with them and start where they were. They didn't have to qualify in terms of a diagnosis. They didn't have to qualify in terms of being eligible for certain benefits or compensation. Indeed, part of the work I found out was that people couldn't get services often because they didn't have any insurance, and they had to get qualified for medical benefits or Social Security or welfare mm-hmm. before they could even be seen in the system, because that's how the system got its pay.
Right.
There were two modalities in the mental health system in the early 80s when I started the chaplain. One was crisis and emergency care, and the other was long-term care. But there was no outreach component mm-hmm. in the system. You had to get there. So that, and so the chaplaincy really was organized to focus on how can we develop a model of effective outreach in the community with those areas of the community where the population of homeless, mentally ill people were highest. Mm-hmm. And so basically from the beginning, it was taking kind of a public health approach. Mm-hmm. That was the model of the chaplaincy. I walked routes downtown each day, began developing skills and theory and practice of outreach.
How did you dress? Did you dress like a minister?
No. I at the root of all of this work was I'm a human being, you're a human being. And so, I dressed as an ordinary mm-hmm. person. There was no outward and visible sign that I was clergy or had any particular mm-hmm. training. And indeed, what I think worked was that I could approach people at the most basic level. It sometimes was just passing by and making a glance, mm-hmm. Saying hello, starting with whatever relational connection would work for that person. tell you an anecdote. I've had students over the years, and often they say, well, do we get a card? These were graduate students mm-hmm. in psychology or ministry. I'd say, well, come back next week, and during supervision, we'll get you a card. And I'd give them a blank 3x5 card. I said, what do you want to write on that? And they'd say, well, I don't know.
So they wanted some kind of an identification card?
Yeah. You know, so-and-so intern with the mental health chaplaincy or student psychologist. The reality is that for many people on the street, for many of us generally, those, you know, if you begin by identifying yourself in terms mm-hmm. of some specialized training and practice, that may actually get in the way.
Yeah, it's like pushing people away.
Because almost. What you're really saying is that I'm that's my side of it, and your side of it is that I'm going to see you as a particular client, patient, mm-hmm. and the role of the chaplaincy was expressed in the notion of companionship, which is that I'm going to share the journey with you as one human being to another. So.
Nice. So did you look around the country or internationally for models that you base this on? Or
I looked at outreach programs, and I didn't find anything that other than, you know, sort of the traditional crisis outreach, mm-hmm. kind of where CDMHPs or flying squads would go to somebody who'd been identified by mm-hmm. the police or the community as being in trouble.
Or a nuisance.
Yeah. And then basically the question was whether they'd go to jail or whether they'd be committed to the hospital or simply left.
Moved on.
In the community. But I didn't see a model of presence, building a relationship in the community, developing some trust, beginning to work with the person in terms of what their mm-hmm. felt and experienced needs were and seeing what small steps could be taken.
So not even any faith-based ones that you saw at that time?
Not with the mental – folks who are struggling with mental health issues.
Specifically, right.
Yeah. I mean, there were missions, faith-based groups praying, shelters, mm-hmm. meal programs. But again, like the larger culture, it was sort of, you know, they were closer to the front lines, but they were still bases of operation mm-hmm. where people would come in mm-hmm. seeking service. But the notion of going out to where a person was and beginning to build a relationship, the model that I use, quite frankly, is the originative model in the Christian community, and that is, you know, the founder of the Christian tradition was a first century Jew who went wandering around the streets and the community, being present with people who were in trouble or struggling, mm-hmm. and so that's it, there was a model, but it's a very very old model.
Okay,
and. It's also a model that had a lot of interest in health, and it had a public sort of educational component to it. That as Jesus, you know, worked with people, he was trying to say, look, you know, this whole notion that these people who are sick are different. No, they're one of us. They're part of mm-hmm. us, and healing is much about returning a person to community as it is about particular treatments and therapeutic resources.
Right.
So that, as much as anything, that would, if there was a model, that was the model of early pastoral care.
Yeah. Nice. So returning people to community, can you give me an example or maybe something, that a story that stands out?
Yeah. There was a fella that he was an Ethiopian refugee. He had become deeply, deeply depressed. Left his home in the community and was eventually admitted to the hospital, and was in the hospital for a couple of weeks, received treatment and care, and was ready for discharge. And about 11 o'clock in the morning, he was supposed to leave. I got a call asking if I would come meet with him because mm-hmm. he was refusing to leave the hospital. Yeah, and so when I talked with him, he said, I need to talk to a priest. And I said, well, what's your background? He said, well, Orthodox. And so I got an Orthodox priest to come, and the priest came, and they talked for a few minutes, and then the priest got out, and he had some anointing mm-hmm. oils, and then he anointed the man with prayer and some chanting, and they finished after a couple of minutes. The man picked up his suitcase and left. And I asked the priest, I said, well, what was that about? And he said, well, in Ethiopia, where this man comes from, if someone leaves the village or the community because of an illness, in order to have the community receive them and welcome them back, there must be a prayer and an anointing which signals to the community all is well with this.
So it's almost like a cleansing to be able to come back.
And a sign that whatever the illness experience has been and whatever might be dangerous about that, contamination, whatever, a disease, someone in authority has signaled to the community, you're welcome back.
Right.
And that for me became a real parable because one of the big issues with mental illness generally and particularly people who are homeless and mentally ill is that finding your way into treatment and care is a problem, but also once you're in care and treatment, finding your way into an inclusive and supportive community is a huge, huge difficulty, a huge challenge. And so a major component of the chaplaincy over time became the development of what we called companions. So we train people in local congregations and community organizations with a set of basic seven practices that would help ordinary folks welcome and share the journey with individuals who were experiencing symptoms of and were in recovery from a major mental illness. So that the part of the inclusion process is to seed throughout the city and the county increasing numbers of people who understood mental illness and who had some basic tools to say, come alongside and share the journey with you. And the part of the model for that was a place called Giel, Belgium, where for seven centuries, this town in Belgium, now about 20,000 people plus, has had what's called family care. And I heard about this. It started in the Middle Ages, and I heard that there were still some families carrying on this tradition of welcoming mentally ill folks into their homes for long term. And when I got there, I found, visiting Giel, there were over 600 families working with 700 chronically mentally ill individuals, welcoming them into their homes. There was a psychiatric hospital. There were five community mental health houses, five neighborhoods, and then folks who were in the program lived in homes in those neighborhoods. The community mental health center in the neighborhood, the community mental health house, had a psychiatrist, general practitioner, psychiatric nurse, social worker, and psychology counselor, a team of five serving 200 people. And the nurse was out in the community every day.
Yay, nursing.
The nurse would visit everyone on that list at least twice a month in their home setting.
Right. And these are people, I take it, that came from all over Belgium.
Well, yeah, from the general region primarily. And one of the symbols was a clock without hands. If you needed to stay in family care, you stayed as long as you needed.
So they actually said that? That was their model?
Yeah. The process from the hospital, the community, if a person went into the hospital, then the team on the hospital would be looking for a placement in the community. And if there was a potential match, the individual from the hospital might go out for lunch or just out for a visit, then out for lunch, then maybe spend a dinner and then a day and then an overnight. And so over a period of 2, 3, 4 weeks, there would be a gradual transition into the life of the home and into a connection with the community-based care team. Every day, staff from the community teams, the five community teams, met with staff from the hospital to talk about who was needing to come out, how things were going in the transition from the hospital out to the community, and then from the community, those people who might need to come back into the hospital. I asked one of my colleagues there, for instance, well, what do you do about people who are, you know, in our framework would qualify for involuntary commitment. So what do you mean? I described somebody who was, you know, very, very gravely ill. And he smiled. He said, well, we would say they're having a bad day. Mm. and then he said, but, you know, Craig, our approach would be that long before a person reaches that level of their illness, we would be proactively seeking, including having someone come into the hospital long before their symptoms became so acute.
Right, because we know that not having safe housing can just exacerbate any kind of mental illness.
And so I said to him, what do you do with folks who are homeless? And he said, well, it's against the law to be homeless in Belgium. I said, that's terrible. He said, no. The people that are prosecuted are public authorities. That it's against the law as a public official to allow someone to remain homeless. It's our job as public officials to ensure that there's a healthcare and housing system such that the most vulnerable are housed and have the support services they need.
That is a different model.
Very different.
So were the families, like, what was their motivation? Did they get paid for this?
Or? Yeah, that would, the equivalent of some rent, but people didn't live like in the garden in a little shack or something. They shared in the family life. So they paid a little rent, and then some portion of their Social Security or public assistance, and then the mental health system gave a stipend to the families.
So, like fostering,
system. In my view, as I looked at it, the cost of the rent and a little bit from the person that helped with that, which and then the stipend, plus this very rigorous and highly trained community support team was very cost effective and no more expensive than the jury-rigged system that doesn't work here.
Right.
Basically, the public health system in Belgium and most other developed countries realizes that a proactive public health approach to mental illness is far preferable to benign neglect and then a reactive system that has many gaps from entrance to inpatient care to community supports. And the families then were recognized as an integral part of the community health resource system.
So did you try to see what parts of that you could bring back here?
Yeah, and one part of it that we were able to begin to do was to build it through education and training a growing number of people who were willing to be companions in their local congregations. And then out of that companionship began to commit to other services like creating shelters, providing housing, and the most robust housing piece that came out of the companionship and model and then working with the Giel model was called a Plymouth House of Healing. And the model there was that a year before that we started the house there, about 12 years ago or more now, Harborview had discharged 1,000 people from its psych units to the streets.
In what time period?
In a year.
In a year, okay.
Yeah. So we were putting literally thousands of dollars into stabilizing a person. And then if they were going to the streets or the shelters, and the step down was huge from one-to-one or more ratio of care, 24/7, a person could go to zero care for 3 weeks, a month, 6 weeks waiting for a first appointment with, and might not even be in any kind of housing. And so what we did was to develop a model where Plymouth Church, through Plymouth Healing Communities, created a house. We brought four companions, volunteers, who would live in the house for a year, a term of a year, sometimes longer. And they would welcome four people who were homeless coming directly from the inpatient units at Harborview to the house. And the stipulation we made was that we would take people directly from the inpatient units, but we asked inpatient and outpatient programs at Harborview to collaborate so that the person left the mm-hmm. hospital with a case manager and a care team in the outpatient program. Mm-hmm. And that was a systemic change because there was nothing in the system that required either the hospital or community mental health centers
to work together
and ensure that a person had community care the instant they left the
right.
hospital.
So this was what year again?
This would have been 2003, 2004, yeah. somewhere in there, 10,
so relatively
12 years
recent.
Ago. Yeah, yeah. And the tradition developed that pretty much the new case manager would bring the person to the house.
Oh, nice.
So you can imagine the difference between a person leaving the hospital and having to walk on their own downtown to find the entrance to a shelter and navigate getting an appointment 3 to 4, 6 weeks later to having a case manager meet with them in the hospital, arrange a time, let them know where the care, continuing care was in the community, and then take them mm-hmm. to this lovely house with a bright red door in their own room with a
nice.
Quilt that had been made for them and four people at the house who were living in there who would just be there 20, you know, was always a companion at the house. So it's not unlike the hospital.
Right.
And there are four folks who were in their convalescence and four folks who were supporting that convalescence. And that's the language we used. We recognized that you could stay at the house for up to 6 months or longer sometimes if needed. It was just simple recognition that 10 days to 2 weeks in the hospital is just the beginning mm-hmm. of the healing process. And because there's no broken bone that needs to – or muscles that need to be rehabbed and exercised. And the most fragile, vulnerable organ in the body.
Mm-hmm.
needs and deserves more than just the hospitalization. An intensive, thoughtful, convalescent support is as important for recovery from a brain attack as from any other.
Right. So what did you do? What what do they do in terms of like co-occurring disorders with substance use?
The requirement at the house was that we would take people at the house, who have a history of co-occurring disorders. But if there was a co-occurring disorder, then the person would make a commitment to continue treatment for that disorder while they were at the house.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a dry house, mm-hmm. no drugs or alcohol. One of the really amazing stories at the house was that a young man came. There was no history of drugs or alcohol. He'd been hospitalized 5 times in the year before coming to the house. Within a day at the house, the companions picked up that he was using, that he was drinking. And they called the case manager and said, you know, we're concerned. There's nothing in the treatment plan. There's nothing in our conversation with him indicate that this has been an issue, but it clearly is. What do we do? And he deteriorated, declined very rapidly, was rehospitalized for 4 or 5 days, in which time there was a treatment plan for the drug-alcohol component put in place, and he returned to the house and never went back to the hospital.
Wow. So the hospital had missed that at least 5 times. Yeah.
Well, and it missed it because he'd apparently the track would be he'd be in jail for a bit and then he'd come to the hospital.
He wasn't drinking in
jail. So, yeah. So they just didn't see.
Yeah.
And he would – yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But – and again, I think that's having people in the community who are sensitive and understanding and not judgmental is a context within which a person then in their convalescent can maybe share some things that weren't necessarily shared in the intense inpatient mm-hmm. setting.
Right, because they're not being judged
yeah.
in the same way.
Yeah.
And
I don't know if you're familiar with Irving Goffman's Asylum, but this notion that we will adapt or perform or behave in terms of what the context is that we're in. The context of living with human peers in a community living situation, sharing meals together, you know, sharing a bathroom down the hall, but with a very flat level of authority and a high sense of peer and mutual life together, both brought out and highlighted what, where some of the struggles were for people just being part of the community.
Right.
So the setting was healing. We didn't try and do therapy or treatment, but we did try and support people in that therapy and treatment and to be a healing community.
And I take it it's still going on, correct?
Yeah. The house is still full.
Right.
And Plymouth Healing Communities has now taken that model of short-term intensive companionship and has something like 36 long-term housing units, mm-hmm. of which are all companioned.
So it is
buildings.
Similar to the
to the Giel. Yeah.
Right. Nice.
People have their own apartments, but there is each of them has a companion, a community companion who visits on a regular basis.
So it's supportive housing, basically.
Very much so.
Yeah.
But the support, a major part of the support component is a relationship with an ordinary human mm-hmm. being from the community.
Mm-hmm.
So that sense of isolation from the larger community is...
They have blank cards.
Yes. And the companions, you know, they're not professionals. they write on their card, you know, my name's Joe, and I'll see you on Thursdays.
Right. So tell me, some of the stories. Doesn't have to be specific, but like the companions, tell me a little bit about them. I take it. I mean, I know it's ecumenical. So mm-hmm. they come from many different faiths.
We've done companionship training, and my colleague Kay Eaton is continuing to do this as I've retired.
Mm-hmm.
We'll work with primarily with faith groups, a congregation or a group of congregations, and we'll do a training about 3 or 4 hours and introduce the basic notions, basic practices. And then we encourage people from the training to form a companionship team within their local faith community or their local organization so they can be mutually supportive of each other. And they do their companioning within the context of a supportive mm-hmm. community. And then, so I'll take an example again at Plymouth. They're a group of Sunday morning companions. So every Sunday there are at least two people at Plymouth, which is a downtown church, has a lot of folks coming and going. And they'll be available from the moment the church doors are open until the last coffee hour is finished. And they're particularly alert for the person who comes in who may be isolated, alone, struggling, suffering. And so they will use the practices is gently approaching the person, observing, beginning with a simple hello, listening to a person's story, however they can tell that, sharing some, you know, simple refreshments or hospitality, just slowly building a relationship. And it may only be a relationship for a few minutes on one Sunday, mm-hmm. but particularly if a person comes back, that relationship will grow. They may sit with the person during the service or in the back, and suddenly someone gets up. There was an interim new pastor at Plymouth, and suddenly some gentleman got up in the middle of the service, and as the pastor was preaching, and he started preaching back at the pastor. And two folks just gently came alongside the fellow,
right.
and they talked to him, and he quieted down. And then the three of them went out, and the pastor, the new pastor afterwards, said to the president of the congregation, "What was that?" "Oh, those are the companions."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "What did they do?" I said, "Well, you saw. I mean, they just were prepared. We always have people around to welcome the stranger, and if they need some support and help and ways to work together, we were able to do that." I said, "That's amazing."
Nice.
That's what we do every Sunday. So that's companionship in action, and we encourage local congregations to at least have Sunday companions. And then some churches may have a meal program or a shelter or a clothing bank, and so companions may be present in those situations and build a relationship with someone at those points of service. One companion, we got a group of people back together. He was with a university district church, and people were talking about how they were doing companions. He said, "Well, I got a ramp companionship."
Oh, RAMP, yeah.
I said, RAMP companionship? Mm-hmm. He said, yeah. Once a week, I go to the RAMP where I-5 gets off to 65th, and I just check in with the folks that are panhandling at the RAMP, and I've gotten to know them and, you know, begin to build a relationship. And then the second phase, I mean, there's an approach phase and then just being a companion, and then a phase of partnership as people express needs, not to meet those needs oneself as a companion, but to say, well, maybe we could try here. Maybe there is a resource. And then the fourth phase is mutuality, where we continue our journeys as fellow human beings and neighbors in the community.
Nice.
So he was doing that in the context of one place in the community where the folks were.
Right.
Yeah. So those are a couple examples.
So I take it it's mainly Christian, but do you also have like Jewish and
Islam? We've done trainings pretty much across the board with done training. There are a number of interfaith mental health groups around the country. In fact, I the last couple of years with the chaplaincy also served as a part-time director of a program called Pathways to Promise, which was a national interfaith mental health resource organization. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we were doing was helping create interfaith mental health groups in cities around the country where companionship training could be done and where we could support the development of mental health teams in local congregations. And in those interfaith groups, we've reached a wide range of religious communities. And it's a challenge to explore how to root this notion of companionship in a variety of faith traditions.
Yeah.
And then I've done trainings, and Kay as well has done trainings, colleagues across the country with a whole range of community homeless services and outreach programs and shelters. And
that are secular.
Secular, but
just knowing how to work across different.
So the secular version of companionship is simply we don't explore necessarily whatever the spiritual roots of companionship might be for a person. But we do introduce the practices and the basic values that can be adopted by just about anyone,
right.
I think.
Right, so it's kind of a human, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you deal and how have you dealt, because I'm sure it's come up, the whole kind of public perception of violence with mental illness?
Well, I think there are a couple of things that need to be said around that. One is that the actual level of violence by individuals who have a severe and persistent mental illness is really quite low and not greatly different from the general population. So, yes, there are people who have a severe and persistent mental illness or episode of mental illness who will be violent. But there are also people without mental illness who will be violent.
Mm-hmm.
We do need to be prepared as a community for violence. I think we could do a lot better in ratcheting down the level of violence, the encouragement to violence generally in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be helpful to all of us. But if the problem with somebody who's experiencing symptoms of mental illness and being angry and maybe threatening, the challenge there is that is to understand how the disorder process, what's going on in the brain, is affecting that person's thinking and behavior, and how one can approach that. To simply, yell at them, drop that gun. It may just stir more agitation in an already agitated and malfunctioning or brain. And the best example I can give of this, we did an annual training at Seattle University, and one year the chief of police from Seattle came, and it was just after he and his officers had been involved in a hours-long confrontation with a mentally ill man who was threatening people with a samurai sword, and they put buses around, and they were shooting water cannons at him. And I remember talking with the chief, and he was saying he and his officers, his staff, were just astonished at how this man persisted, in standing up to whatever was going on. It was almost supernatural. We had a nurse educator who was talking about what's going on in the brain when somebody's experienced schizophrenia or depression or bipolar disorder. And a light went off for him. He said, oh, I now understand. You know, that this guy's brain was not working the way brains usually work. And so a lot of what we were doing just wasn't being processed by him. Is that right? Yeah. And she also talked about how ratcheting down the emotional level, quieting the situation.
Getting rid of the water cannons probably would have helped.
Yeah. And that led then to a long discussion and involving some of the local NAMI folks, and then bringing in crisis intervention training for the police officers, which we developed a week-long course. 40-hour training with the police on drugs and alcohol, mental illness, developmental disabilities, and putting into the officers' repertoires some understanding and practices that might be more helpful when they confront or come upon someone with a mental illness.
Yeah. Having that in their toolkit. So, again, maybe for people that listening that don't know NAMI.
National Alliance on Mental Illness, which is really a family and peer group with chapters all over the country. It's probably the largest citizen advocacy group for.
Yeah, they do some really good work.
Yeah. And local chapters here were very active in working with the local police department. And that's waxed and waned. I mean, but again, I think it needs to be part of a regular training. The solution in the long run, or the direction in the long run, needs to be shifting the system from a reactive, making the hospital emergency room sort of the entry point for many people into the system, to saying, let's make sure that everyone is insured, that their insurance includes access to behavioral health services, mental health services. And as a culture, we destigmatize mental illness, and when somebody expresses some depression or begins to hear voices or is thinking delusionally or is highly anxious and traumatized, that at the very front end of the health system, nurses, general practitioners, family doctors, pediatricians, school counselors, school nurses, public health departments, we're all part of a front end, a very porous, very open front end network that says, let's pick up on these signals and then make appropriate referrals. One example of that is a discussion just this last week in the paper. 14% of mothers experience pre- or postpartum depression, mood disorder. And so a recommendation, I'll begin to screen.
Right, ask for it.
Well, that's the next step. Then, you know, screening's great. Let's find out who may need services. But then the question was raised, well, you know, the family practice doc, the OBGYN, the pediatrician aren't necessarily equipped to follow up. So, again, we need to put in place a robust mental health system that supports anyone who's been diagnosed or recognized as having a need for some mental health support and services.
And then having supportive housing or whatever it is to integrate them into the community.
Right? I mean, part of the issue with homelessness, Josephine, is that when we, in the late 60s, before we started closing down the state hospitals,
The mental health institution.
Mental health hospitals like Western State, Eastern, Stillicum, and so on. The average length of stay in the state hospital was 25 years. So if you were diagnosed with a major mental illness in your late teens, early 20s, you'd spend most of your adult life in the state hospital. And in the early days, the state hospital, I mean, there were jobs, there were newspapers, there was gardening, there was three square meals a day. I mean, some were snake pits, but others were pretty decent places for many, many folks. When the Congress put together the Community Mental Health Act, they projected a full-service community mental health center for every 200,000 people in the country. That mental health center was to be include a 24/7 walk-in emergency room, outpatient services to follow up, a minimum 10 to 12 bed inpatient program on site, so that if you walked in the walk-in, you could go on up to the emergency or the inpatient program if it was appropriate. And then those would be run by community boards who would also look at education, supportive housing, and the support services necessary in the community. So there was a vision in 1963 when we began to think about closing down the state hospital system. There was a vision for a network of community mental health centers across the country. Funding was only made available for a quarter of those. And even those, not all of them were the full model, full service model. And the basic thing is that we stopped funding those. The startup funding ended, and so no more were built. And there was really no provision for expanding services there, filling in the rest of them that were needed, and providing the housing.
And connecting with other health services.
Absolutely, yeah. Integrating mental health. So it wasn't until just a few years ago, a couple of years ago, that we got mental health parity, which meant that insurance programs, whatever they were, had to include behavioral health services at the same level with any other health issue and treatment resource. So in a number of areas, both in terms of paying for treatment, putting together community mental health programs, integrating primary care and mental health, providing supported housing, we never put in place what was needed to welcome the people who came from the hospitals, the state hospitals. The first wave went into nursing homes, basically. The second wave ended up on the streets. And then communities, because they saw homelessness, began slowly to develop housing. Well, 10 years ago, the goal was to create 10,000 units of housing for the 10,000 people we knew were homeless in King County. 10 years later, we still have 10,000 plus people who are homeless.
And growing.
Yeah. And that problem is that as the population grows, every cohort of people 18 to 25, 27, 30 has up to 10, 12, 14% of folks in that age cohort are vulnerable to a serious mental illness. And so with every cohort of 18 to 30-year-olds, we've got a certain number of us. I experienced the first episode of my major depression when I was 21. I mean, it's not uncommon. Tithe of humanity will experience this. And yet we have not built the care resources needed if we recognize that at least 10% of the population is going to struggle with these issues. Right? There's no rocket science to it. I mean, that's until we can figure out more deeply what the nature of these disorders are and maybe find some cures. There's no test. I mean,
Well, we know that it's deeply tied to poverty and stress. So again, I mean, we know that. So no pill's going to take care of that.
No, the triggers are clearly it was an interaction between some biological potential and enough stress, enough trauma. Anyone can begin to develop symptoms of mental health issues. So recognizing that, and this gets into my deepest bias. I actually, when I did the postgraduate work, and I was actually thinking about going into peace organizing. And my time at the hospital working with folks who were homeless and mentally ill, I realized that, boy, if we can't bring some level of peace to our neighbors on the streets in our communities, there's no hope for us being a more peaceable presence in the larger world. We need to learn how to be peaceable and healing at the most fundamental levels of our common life, as families, as neighbors, as cities and towns, communities. And so
this is your peace work.
This is my peace work, yeah. And I think that's one of the gifts of both experiencing a mental illness and sharing the journey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we come up against some of the most profound, existential, real struggles of being a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And it asks of us and those around us a real tenderness and care. And as you begin to practice a healthy life out of mental illness and a supportive care for those who experience mental illness, we realize that a violent, harsh, hard, charging, competitive, driving society isn't nearly so healthful.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like your experience, your own personal experience with a deep depression has helped you this work?
Oh, absolutely, in the long run. Mm-hmm. But it took me a long time to acknowledge. I mean, when I first started working in the chaplaincy, I would talk about those who experience mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started talking about those among us who experience mental illness. And one day I slipped and I said, those of us who experience mental illness. And I realized, oh, I'm drawn to this work because I am – these are my people. I'm one of those.
Yeah.
And I've experienced a certain degree of recovery from the episode, the most powerful episode of major mental illness. But – it's literally been a lifelong journey to continue moving towards some kind of wholeness and deal with the vulnerability. And I mean, 3 years ago, I was at a suggestion of my primary care physician who did a screening, said, well, you're experiencing some mild to moderate depression. How about I make a referral to our behavioral health people? And I said, okay. And I'd been on medication. I wasn't, terribly active with my symptoms, but I wasn't at my best for sure. And I got a 3, 4, 5 months course of cognitive behavioral therapy, which I had never had before.
Mm.
And it was right on.
Mm.
So
you experienced the system working.
Yeah. I mean, so it was the first time I'd had a concurrent psychotherapy with the medication, which we know is the last time I had talked with another general practitioner I'd had for several years, I said, I think I'm not doing so well. Could you suggest a psychiatrist? And he went on the computer and he looked and he said, well, here's a group that might be that's associated with our larger practice and hear the names.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I looked at it. I was in the field. I looked it up, and they were specialists in psychotherapy with people who had MS and other sort of physical diseases.
Chronic illnesses.
Yeah, chronic illnesses. Yeah. At least I'd like to work with somebody who specializes maybe in depression. But they were also – they weren't therapists. And so I realized again that how far the overall system is from being a well-integrated healthcare system in which those of us who struggle with mental health issues have sort of the equal level of care that somebody with another kind of disorder might have. Much more smooth transitions from a diagnosis of cancer to an oncologist, heart problems to docs who specialize in heart care.
Yeah, cardiology.
And
the whole mind-body split that we still have in our society.
But it's I think the other thing that I've realized over the years is that, I mean, to be human is to live in an imperfect world, mm-hmm. and not to be perfect oneself. And mm-hmm. so I'm troubled by the most egregious and gross inadequacies of the system. But I also know that this is an ongoing journey for all of us mm-hmm. to move toward our maximum wholeness as persons, and also to work at creating families, neighborhoods, mm-hmm. communities, countries that have a more holistic, healthy approach to life. So, mm-hmm.
so I'm kind of hearing that you've learned how to deal with a righteous indignation and anger a bit. Is it?
I'm getting there.
Working on it. So, but that leads me to a question that I'm asking a lot of the people, because I think it's really important also to pass on wisdom to future mm-hmm. generations, is how have you, like, what have you done to try and prevent or to deal with professional burnout?
I have been blessed with extraordinary colleagues, both in the ministry and social work, human services, the medical community. So professionally, I have always worked as part of teams. Mm-hmm. And as part of systems, even though that can be frustrating at times, mm-hmm. I think we need to acknowledge that there's not a lot we can do as lone rangers. Mm-hmm. That's a recipe for burnout. Mm-hmm. Second thing is that all the years, particularly I was in the chaplaincy, I had a peer.
Supervisor. Spiritual,
well, a peer spiritual support. Mm. Somebody else who was working mm-hmm. as a chaplain or as a pastor, so that we would talk together. Mm-hmm. Training for the field, I had a tremendous amount of good supervision. And then the other thing that was, you know, I have to say is that I had a ton of therapy mm-hmm. while I was coming up in the field. So mm-hmm. I've been trying to attend to some of my own vulnerabilities and blind spots, and I think any of us who are in this field will benefit from our own therapy and healing mm-hmm. experience.
So, what do you mean by therapy, though? Because then you also mentioned that the CBT, the cognitive
behavioral, I've been through three important therapy processes, I think, in my life. The first one was with a pastoral counselor who mm-hmm. was a Jungian in background and sort of opened me to the richness of who I was as a person. And there was some healing that went on in that process. I worked for many years. I was part of a group psychoanalytic experience.
Yeah.
So when I first went to the psychologist to say, I think I could use some help, he said, well, I think you'd benefit from being in one of my groups. And I said, well, I don't do groups. I lead groups. And he said, exactly. So there was a benefit of just being with some others who mm-hmm. were struggling with their issues. And again, sort of opening to some of the hidden processes and dimensions of our own psychology and our relational life, and then the CBT. So part of what that – I'm very much open to a kind of holistic approach to wellness.
Mm-hmm.
Our daughter died in a bike bus accident about 3 years ago, and another occasion for struggling with some of the deep issues. And a friend introduced us to a Lummi, a Native American healer. And my initial reaction was, I don't know about talking with a shaman. But it turned out to be a very, very helpful and healing experience. And so I just have come out of this journey with an appreciation for both our fragility, our complexity, and how many ways others can help us mm-hmm. and support us. And that brings me to the last piece of what's been supportive for me in all this work, and that's my wife and children, mm-hmm. my family.
Mm-hmm.
They've just been extraordinarily supportive, and they're the incredible gifts without which I could not have even begun to think about doing this work.
So having a really strong, rich personal life as well.
Yeah. And understanding and accepting, and but also saying, you know, we're important too, mm-hmm. and how do you balance this, you know?
The checks and balances. The people that can be honest with us. Yeah, that's good.
So it, again, you put together health out of a lot of pieces and with the help of a lot of people. And I think that goes to one of the main issues with mental illness. It can be so isolating.
Mm-hmm. I sometimes and stigmatized, talk, including self-stigmatizing.
I sometimes talk about mental health care as, you know, sort of a cross-cultural work of one, because mm-hmm. each of us in the midst of our illness experience is sort of in a unique place. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure anybody understands what's going on.
Right.
So it can be very isolating, and hence a component of any helpful care and treatment is to attend to that isolation and to offer ways to connect and relate mm-hmm. and be included.
And to work on our own isolation then, it sounds like, too, as part of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's...
Because people know when we're not doing that. Right. Yeah. So what are your hopes for the future in terms of all of this work, especially in King County, but nationally as well?
Well, I think my hope would be that we could go forward in King County as part of a national strategy. And I was very hopeful when the Affordable Care Act passed, because I realized that making insurance available to as many people as possible, or making access to insurance if somebody were diagnosed or came into the system, was important, and that insurance could include support mm-hmm. for behavioral health treatment and care. So I think that needs to go forward. We need some form of universal health care. How that's structured is less important to me than that we have, and that everyone have it, so that if an issue comes up, getting care and services, mm-hmm. that you have to qualify for that care before mm-hmm. you can. That shouldn't be the case. You should be able to go into care and treatment as soon and as possible, and that the system then should be incentivized to care for people at the earliest possible sign of a mental health issue. Not wait until a person is, you know, needing involuntary treatment. So that universal health care insurance that includes behavioral health care on parity. Second thing is that the organization of health care be proactively organized, so that mental health screenings are part of regular
primary health care.
Mm-hmm. And that the referral process to behavioral health care, that co-location of services. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that the community mental health center model even makes sense in the long run, mm-hmm. that every health program should be a place where behavioral health care mm-hmm. is available and a person one-stop.
Right, and they're center. In the community.
Yeah, and that part of that system, because of the unique nature, the isolating nature of mental illness, that healthcare system have some outreach component mm-hmm. on a public health model that's particularly tuned to people who begin to experience symptoms, and one of those symptoms being withdrawal. Mm-hmm. So that we're, you know, the answer to a family is, well, if you can get them to come into the center, we'll take a look at it. If they're willing to have treatment, well, that's part of the issue. It's one of the symptoms mm-hmm. that the person doesn't think they're ill, and they're not willing to go for treatment. We need to take that into account and not simply accept that as, well, that's tough.
Right.
But we need to train people who can go out and begin to build an assertive outreach component to the healthcare system, and particularly for those who experience disorder diseases, which make it difficult for them to get in.
That they're not being bad people, that it's actually
part
of
they're not treatment resistant. They're not
illness.
Non-compliant. They're ill.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't say to a person who has, two broken legs, you know, if you can crawl your way to the ER, we'll take care
right.
of you.
Or what did you do to get those?
Yeah.
It's
well,
your fault.
Yeah. You won't come in? No. So a proactive system that has that begins with an outreach component rather than and ends with tertiary care hospitalization. We put as much many resources into assertive outreach as we put into tertiary care. And then I think that a third component of this is to organize in every neighborhood supportive housing for folks who may be vulnerable or in convalescence or need. And I mean every neighborhood.
Including the gated ones?
Including the gated ones. I've worked with people who come from multi-million dollar homes who are on the streets of Seattle. I've worked with people who have PhDs on the streets of Seattle struggling with a mental illness. It's a disorder, an illness that any of us can experience. And to develop a handful of isolated sort of warehousing apartments here and there in the cheapest land that we can find, long ways from other services. It doesn't seem to me to
like
be
Western State.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a step down from Western. Yeah. And that's why I like the Giel model. Every neighborhood in this community had homes where people with mental illness were living, had a community mental health resource, in the neighborhood. So that's my
– That's what your hope is, yeah.
It's a very public health sort of model.
And so what – because we were talking before the interview of your hope for – some of the restructuring of King County services for this. Is that something you'd be willing to
Yeah,
say?
I think that if I were to be able to wave my magic wand, I think what I would want to see is mental health services, an overview of mental health services be located with the public health department. So the public health department would be charged with saying, every health piece of the health care system in the county is set up in a way that is proactive in terms of outreach, education, support, care, and treatment for those who are
prevention.
Yeah, absolutely. And that mental health advocacy work in the public health department would include making sure that those who are responsible for providing housing and rehabilitation, convalescence, just like they do with nursing homes and other resources. And we take an overview of that and put that be located within public health. And then that information goes out to community services in the county and to each of the municipalities in the area to encourage development of supportive and appropriate housing. So that there's a network of housing, and then that the county be city county public health department would be the center for crisis services, so they could keep track of why it is and how it is that people are slipping through the cracks.
The surveillance part of it,
so that it becomes an epidemiological study in a sense to say, okay, we've had 200 people this month who've needed crisis and commitment services.
Or like the 1,000 from Harvey that we're getting.
We had 1,000 people who were discharged. That someone is charged with looking at where the system breaks down or where this illness experience is most acute and says, okay, why is that happening? It doesn't have to happen.
Then they have the authority to make the changes.
To begin to change back up the system.
Right.
So they can say, well, sure looks like there's a process of people getting arrested, going to jail, languishing in jail, being discharged, and then ending up in the ER. That's just one pattern.
Right.
We're using the criminal justice system as a dumping ground and alternative to care and treatment. How do we change that?
Yeah. And working with the drug court and the mental health court.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And then and I think that's part of what's missing now. I don't know that there is an outreach component now to the mental health system. It needs to be further developed, I think. But there's not a central place where a sort of epidemiological overview mm-hmm. of how these disorders are developing, what their natural history is in our communities, and how we can change systemic responses so that people don't end up on the streets. Mm-hmm. It's not a given. I was talking with a colleague years ago from Scotland, Edinburgh, and he asked me how many folks there were on the streets in Seattle. And he said, there were roughly 8,000-9,000 at that point. He said, how many of those would be mentally ill? And I said, probably 2/3 mm-hmm. if national statistics mm-hmm. hold. And then I said to him, well, how many – Edinburgh's a comparable size mm-hmm. to Seattle. I said, how many are homeless in Edinburgh on any given night? I said, I think last we counted there were 5 or 6. Mm-hmm. 5 or 6. I mean, he could practically name, mm-hmm. as a major city official, a city councilor, he said, it's just and if you're struggling with mental illness, you just don't become homeless. That's not,
they have much better access to primary health care and everything.
Giel, nobody was homeless.
It is colder there.
But that's my takeaway from a lot of this is that it's not a given.
Yeah, right, that we can do it. We can do much better. And, of course, now Seattle is in the international news in terms of homelessness.
But
things are changing.
Similar to many, many, many places around the country. And I think the mayor is right that we need a national strategy. Mm-hmm. We basically need to go back to 1963 and revisit a national community mental health vision mm-hmm. and then commit to making it work.
Right.
With funding and structure that makes sense to the nature of these disorders.
Yeah, still a lot of work to do. So is there any question that I have not asked you that you'd want to, any issue you want to address?
Yeah, there's something we haven't talked about that, and that's research. And a national program of research that really gets at the development of the most effective treatments for these various disorders. Funding for NIMH and for research generally for medications. It's been there, but I don't think it hasn't been a major priority.
Hasn't had parity.
No,
with
hasn't
a lot
had
of
parity. And then when you look at how much money we put into things that directly create more mental illness, like the military and deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan and the experience of war, the lack of resources for people who are impoverished, a limited number of physicians, nurses, I mean, training for healthcare professionals, both in terms of social factors and disease process, understanding of these disorders. I think a major research effort that builds a substantial body of knowledge so we're addressing the stigma and myths around mental illness much more profoundly than we have to date. I think that would be helpful. Yeah.
Nice. Okay.
Thank you.
So thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.